I'm going to go ahead and just kind of launch right into this. So I'm calling this presentation Cloud Launch because we've talked a lot about what NASA's doing in the cloud. We've talked about kind of our strategy. We've talked about how it's going to work. But now I want to really tell you about it and what people are doing with it. And this is something that I think really tells the story better than anything. So first of all, I want to kind of frame our challenge. We have a lot of data to deal with at NASA. That's just a sample of actual satellites in Earth orbit right now. We don't operate all of those, but all of those satellites are generating data. And this is just Earth. You know, we've got Mars and a couple other things deployed out into the solar system. And so, you know, NASA is increasingly becoming a very data-driven agency. And I think a lot of companies, a lot of other federal agencies are also finding themselves swimming in data. Arguably, you can't, you know, send astronauts to Mars. You have to send robots to Mars at this point. And so the only way they share the stories and do the research and do the science is by bringing back massive amounts of data. And we can either throw the data away or we can store the data, process the data, share the data, and work with the data. Now, the challenge is we have a decadal survey where we talk about the new science platforms we're building, and some of these things that we're building, and just recently deployed the Solar Dynamics Observatory that takes 16 megapixel images of the sun every 6 seconds, generating over a terabyte of data a day. The LSST telescope is going to generate upwards of an exabyte of data in its lifetime by taking a full survey of the entire night sky several times a night. This, you know, if you start doing the math, if we were to buy storage at $10,000 a terabyte, which is kind of what most federal agencies pay, an exabyte would cost us $10 billion if I carried the zeros correctly. So that's about half our budget. And so we can't spend half of NASA's budget on storage. So we've got to really think very differently about how we do things. And I think cloud is forcing us to look at this very differently, both the public clouds that are out there and what we're going to do with a private cloud. So just kind of narrowing in a little bit and kind of focusing down, these are the satellites that just generate a tremendous amount of Earth science data, which is of a lot of interest to everybody down here on Earth. And some of this data, I'm going to talk about how it's being used on Nebula today. So basically, this is kind of where we're at right now. We have the largest Intel-based supercomputer on the planet, almost 150,000 cores in one place, in one shared memory environment. But the challenge is that's great for about 100 people at NASA. You got to wait in line for it. It's a high-performance computing environment, so you got to tune your code for it. You know, there are thousands of scientists that don't have the privilege of running in that environment, and what do? They buy computers, and they put them under their desks. They buy clusters. They put them in their lab. They fill up our data centers. We have over 70 data centers that are filled up with infrastructure. We spend almost $2 billion a year on IT at NASA. And a lot of that goes into infrastructure that we operate to store data, to process data. So you know, this is the challenge. We've got to figure out a way to do this more efficiently. And whenever you need to buy a computer, that's a six-month process. You know, you have to procure it. You have to get a security plan developed for it. You've got to, you know, get the thing, provisioned. It's a challenge. So we started thinking about this, and we started to build what you guys now know as Nebula. Hopefully, many of you. This is a platform which is based on shipping containers. We have several of these now. One's out here at Goddard Space Flight Center, just outside of DC. The basic concept is if you can put up to 40 petabytes of storage in one of these. 80 petabytes when you start getting the larger disks, a couple of tens of thousands of CPU cores, and then you run open source software, you start actually bringing the cost of storage down to the point where it's tens or hundreds of dollars a terabyte. So only marginally more than what the raw disks cost, right? But the challenge is, just like a large service provider, if we were buying very expensive software licenses to build this, again, it would exceed the NASA's budget just for the licenses to kind of run this in a commercial environment. So, you know, and what you're paying for is a lot of things that are great if you're moving SAP onto a virtual environment, not so important if you have 100 petabytes of science data and you don't need all of those enterprise features. So for big data, for big science data, you know, there's just not a good fit for what we're doing. Also, if we have to move it around our network, moving it out to the internet means we're paying a lot of money to get it into a public cloud provider and then get it back out of a public cloud provider. So especially when we generate the data on our networks, on our systems, and pull it down from space,
paying those internet transit fees into the public clouds just kills us. And so it's not just the cost of storage and the cost of compute, which basically, you know, if you can predict how much capacity you need, you can do it less expensively yourself. So there's a really strong private cloud argument here is basically where I'm going with this. The architecture is based on commodity hardware, and this is kind of a logical architecture. We're running direct attached storage with compute and storage all in the same fabric with 10 gigabit Ethernet. So it's kind of distributed across a massively parallel 10 gigabit Ethernet network where every host can have up to 4 blades with each blade having 12 disks that are 2 terabytes each. So we can put very storage dense or very CPU dense. We can also go with GPU blades in the environment. So there's a really flexible environment where within one cabinet we can put up to about a petabyte or 2 of disks, spinning disks, very dense, or many thousands of CPU cores with the 6-core Westmere processors. That's kind of what it looks like inside, so that's kind of a narrow aisle right down the edge of a container. The beautiful thing about this in the government is building facilities is expensive. We have facilities that are reasonably modern facilities where we operate our supercomputers, and we literally can't fill racks with disks because they would fall through the floor, right? And so when you start thinking about planning for facilities for the next 30 years, you know, if that's the timetable, can you predict the future? 30 years from now, what IT is going to look like? You know, whether holographic storage, flash storage, solid state, I mean, what's going to happen with that? You know, is your future infrastructure going to fall through the floor or fit on an iPhone? You know, it's hard to place bets in the government on that kind of timescale when the pace of innovation with IT is occurring. So with a shipping container, you buy the whole thing. You depreciate it over 3 years, moving on, right? The container is not that expensive. In fact, if you buy it all pre-populated, they just pull it up. Drop it off. You plug it in. You have your facility. You depreciate it over 3 years. They pull it away. You know, you can see where this is going. So arguably, if you buy servers in boxes, they were once in a container because they were manufactured overseas, and then we pull them out of boxes and we pay people to plug them in, and so that's kind of inefficient. Logically, so this is kind of what the software architecture looks like. Basically, there's API servers that give us EC2 and S3 compatible APIs, so it's kind of like Eucalyptus in that regard, though it isn't Eucalyptus. We have authorization managers, which right now are compatible with LDAP, but there's work going on right now to add Kerberos and Active Directory. Object stores, which support up to 5 terabyte objects. Volume controllers, network controllers, schedulers, and compute controllers. So this is the foundation for infrastructure as a service, but it's open source. So what does this mean to end users? It means that you can have nice, pretty web interfaces, so your users can kind of go and create virtual machines, run them, launch 1,000 of them, and use a kind of comfortable web UI. These are basically built on top of REST web HTTP APIs, so you can actually build your own software to manage this. Any software that does cloud scaling, like Scalar, RightScale, is completely compatible with this environment. So if you want to do bursting from your private cloud into a public cloud environment that's compatible with these APIs, you can do that. So what we're trying to do is take where there are no standards, where NIST is talking about standards, which is great, that process might take years. There are de facto standards that are evolving. There are standards which haven't been ratified yet. OVF, we're talking about what's the format of a virtual disk, what's the format of the definition of a virtual machine, what's the definition of a virtual network. As companies implement these things, there are things that are working, there are things that are not working, there are things that don't work for government. And so by having an open source cloud that the government uses, this is a reference implementation of what NIST is doing. If there are things that you want to do to monitor the environment, you can implement that here, you can test it out. Much harder to do if you're kind of depending on the software lifecycle of commercial products. Let's see, so today, I don't know what all that adds up to, but it's I think about 350 users and projects across NASA that are using Nebula. So this number was about zero about 9 months ago. So we've gone from about zero to 400 projects. I know Vivek wanted 3, so I think we're doing okay here. Now these are probably people testing stuff and you know doing some development work, and so these aren't like major huge systems that people are running on Nebula, but it gives you a sense of the interest that's there, and these are the kind of roughly from different NASA centers. And so there's even 5 from Alabama, which is cool, because they were mad at me for doing this at one point, I think. So I'm going to tell you about 3 that are just really inspiring to me. There's a project actually at a Goddard Space Flight Center where they have actually literally discovered 1,000 new galaxies because of nebula. This was work that they've been paid by NASA to do on a computing cluster, which they purchased. And they were able to process the images from the space telescope to a certain level of fidelity. But if you look at those images that are processed, you see little specks. And those specks are actually galaxies. And the challenge is they don't have enough compute power to do the additional fine-grained data processing to classify those. And what you're actually seeing here is the result of one of those pixels that's been processed because they had 100 times more compute capacity at basically no incremental cost. And so this is an example of opportunistic science, where the taxpayers only had so much money to get so much value out of data, but because that data was on a platform that could basically elastically scale, and we could provide that scientist with 1,000 times that capacity that he originally could budget for, we were able to do some incredible science work. And there's actually a few more pieces of data here. So this is kind of what they were able to do with normal, like one computer. So you can kind of see how this scales. So being able to process the entire night sky, they would basically need 100,000 cores. And that's just far more than what they had bought and procured and deployed in their environment. Another really cool project, we do work with the Future Air Traffic Control System. What you're seeing here, we typically have researchers that take a day of air traffic data, and they model it out to understand the patterns and how things are affected. These guys basically took an entire year of data and fed it to Nebula and ran it in the environment. And basically, this gives them a whole new view into the data that they wouldn't have otherwise had with the scale of the project that they were running. So this is a really cool project. And again, this is data that we can't share. There's a lot of sensitivity around this particular data. And while with respect to the panelists up here, a lot of work is going into the standards around security, and they're doing some incredible innovation in this area. I do think that a private cloud is a necessary stepping stone because the issues are not always real. These guys can solve every technology issue that's out there and provide complete confidence to someone at a federal agency that environment is completely bulletproof and secure, more secure than anything the government could ever do. And there will still be people inside federal agencies that have perception issues, culture, they have existing people that feel a certain way. Right? They have tools that work a certain way. They have processes that just can't adapt to running something out in the cloud. And it's going to be an investment in order to retool those systems and those security tools to work in the cloud. And so this is a process. And so if we can start taking these baby steps, once you've virtualized an application, you're more than halfway there. And so what's exciting to me is agencies that adopt private clouds are helping every single project take more than one step towards, I'd say 90% of the way to a public cloud. And so as we work these issues out, there will be a tidal wave of additional savings once we don't have to operate any infrastructure internally within the government. So another great example here. This is a project called Servier. Again, same kind of profile. They had a certain amount of money to buy a certain amount of infrastructure, and now they're able to do incredibly high fidelity local weather forecasting because of this additional computational capability. What's interesting is when we built Nebula, we actually built it for people to build websites because we thought it was a great way. NASA has 3,000 public-facing websites. Not proud of that. But each of these sites is based on a different system with a different kind of back end. And by trying to create a shared web application framework, we thought we could solve that problem. We couldn't solve that problem because of FISMA, and because if one bad piece of code got uploaded into that shared environment, you could take out the whole thing. And so virtualization allowed us to basically contain these different environments and put security boundaries around them that could be at least compatible with FISMA low security plans. And as it turns out, no one wanted to use it for that. What everybody wanted to use it for was not buying workstations and building clusters in their labs, which is it's a great thing to use it for. Now, I know what you guys are thinking. You're thinking, okay, wonderful NASA, you guys are so smart, you did all this stuff. And it's not me, by the way. I have this awesome team that just makes me look good because they work their butts off out in Silicon Valley. And this is all for us. But a few months ago, everybody loves it. A few months ago, after being contacted by a lot of different organizations, a lot of different federal agencies, saying we want to deploy something like this, how do we do it? We want to collaborate with you. We just didn't have the bandwidth to respond to all those people that wanted to deploy this in their environment. So a consortium of companies that were all interested in there being an open source cloud stack came up with this concept of creating an open stack. And they were about ready to contribute a whole bunch of code, but they looked at the code that we'd released under an Apache 2.0 license, which is the NASA Nova Nebula Fabric Controller, which is the computing engine behind Nebula. And they actually thought it was better than what they had built. And so they came to us and they said, since you've released this under an Apache license, how about we release our stuff and we'll incorporate what you've released into this thing called OpenStack? And since then, we have... that's actually an old slide. There's actually now over 1,000 developers that have submitted features, bug fixes in 12 different countries and over 100 companies. And these companies include, Intel, AMD. We actually have Hyper-V support courtesy of Microsoft and cloud.com. This platform now has some momentum, which is fantastic because if you're interested in doing a cloud, but you have some use case that precludes you from using a public cloud, but you still want to run VMware, or you still want to run Hyper-V, or you still want to run Zen Server, now you can. And you can actually build a service class, service provider class, horizontally scalable cloud in your data center. And this is a platform that you can download from the web today and get going. So the neat thing about this is, first of all, it is to the data center what Linux is to the personal computer. That doesn't mean you don't need Microsoft, right? It just means there is an alternative, which is open source, which in these very early days of the cloud, when everybody's talking about customizing this to give you this kind of real-time monitoring, or as we're kind of adapting to new policy frameworks and FedRAMP and some of the work coming out of FTCC, this gives you an environment that you can actually develop on. You know, you could hire a developer or two, and you can meet a specific requirement you have and accelerate your ability to adopt the cloud. And you're building it on a platform which is API compatible with everything else that's going on in industry. So we're super excited about the fact that Nebula is now available to everyone, and there's a community of companies, an open community of companies, which is open to everyone. So if you're interested in collaborating with people working on this, contributing code, contributing bug fixes, running it, NASA taxpayer dollars don't have to be used to go support that because we were created to go explore space and not support open source projects. So it's delightful that the work we've done has been advanced by this community of organizations. So just in summary, I just want to say that it's been an incredible year or two, and the future for infrastructure services, platform services, and software services. We have only scratched the surface of the potential of this. And what I've said before is, if you look at every application that's been deployed at NASA, we still have mainframes running. They're almost gone. But, I mean, think about that for a second. That's pretty old technology. That means there are systems that we just haven't taken the time to make the investment to adapt to run in Oracle or SQL Server or MySQL or whatever. The challenge is... 1,000 times greater for cloud. If you think about every application that's ever run in any of your data centers, it doesn't like it when one of its nodes fails, right? It doesn't like it when one database cluster fails over to another. People's pagers go off, right? You know, raise your hand if all of your systems are redundantly implemented so that they're in a failover configuration. Right. So you see, the cloud actually means that when people aren't using your apps, it shuts everything off. You know, true elasticity means when something's not being used, it's not consuming power. And when a request comes in, a queue fires up an instance and runs the app and starts the machinery going. A true cloud environment is truly elastic. It's truly not consuming energy. It's truly not doing anything if it's not being used. And it can deprovision resources just as fast as it can provision them. And so, I mean, I think if we think about every application that's ever been written, the only apps that work that way are the new cloud applications that are built on top of these new internet-scale businesses, and like Zynga, you know, that uses Amazon. Very few business applications and enterprise applications truly take advantage of the cloud. And so I think we need to really focus on all of the goodness that comes out of data center consolidation. I think we need to focus on all the goodness that comes out of virtualization. And then there's this whole new wave of goodness that comes out of the real cloud, you know, the true elastic, metered, pay-as-you-go cloud. And so I think one of the things that I hope happens in this forum with all of you and all of your projects is you treat those things separately, right? Because they're very different things. They're very different companies, markets, ecosystems, products, approaches, strategies that you need to have to succeed in each of those areas. You know, if you're virtualizing stuff in data centers, you need to buy some commercial products like VMware or like Hyper-V or like Oracle's Hypervisor. And I'm not endorsing any of these companies or Zen Server. I think I covered them all there. because that's what they're designed to do. They're designed to take the last 25 years of enterprise applications and make sure that they run as if they were in a virtual data center so that you can have the failover type configurations that you need, the storage performance. You know, you're buying EMC storage or NetApp storage or other vendor storage that's high performance. And if you're virtualizing your data center, that's the caliber of stuff that you need. If you're trying to do really pioneering, re-architecting your entire application in the cloud, and you can't use Amazon, you're going to need something like this, right? And that's kind of the reason why we created it at NASA. So I think those are all the prepared comments I have. If you guys have any questions, I will take those.